Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. The New York State Energy Planning Board released its 2025 draft state energy plan this week. As the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports, the plan outlines New York's efforts to combat climate change and decarbonize the grid over the next 15 years.
The plan's release follows the Trump administration's apparent disdain for offshore wind and solar power. President Donald Trump, on his first day in office, signed an executive order halting all federal wind permits. Doreen Harris is president and CEO of NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. She says the state is facing headwinds from the federal government on several aspects of energy planning, with New York now looking to build a diverse energy supply to address long-term needs.
So we're looking at our fossil fuel infrastructure. We're looking at the build-out of renewables. But we're also looking at the other types of generation, like nuclear.
Governor Kathy Hochul last month directed the New York Power Authority to develop and construct the state's first new nuclear power facility in a generation. Efforts to develop the draft state energy plan began in September 2024. New York has ambitious climate goals under the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. The plan calls for 100% zero emission electricity in 2040.
So it's a plan through 2040, and it is looking at our energy systems, all energy systems, given that they are all integrated in our own personal lives, our state's economic development opportunities, and the ways in which we rely on our infrastructure to support that quality of life. So the plan is really solving not only for the needs of the energy system, but the mutual objectives of affordability, reliability, and economic development, all while supporting equity and a healthy environment.
As it seeks to gather input from the public, the State Energy Planning Board is hosting virtual and in-person hearings during August and September to educate people about the effort. NYSERDA Senior Advisor for Policy and Analysis, Hillel Hammer, is focusing on the public health impact analysis of the plan.
Total cumulative benefits over the plan period from 2025 to 2040, for example, avoided premature mortality at around 9,700 cases, non-fatal heart attacks, 4,100 cases, asthma-related emergency room visits, 12,500 cases. So these are substantial benefits over the period.
President and CEO and Commissioner at Empire State Development, Hope Knight, hails the plan as a thoughtful analysis of the state's energy system and its future in a time of uncertainty that encourages state agencies to engage in cross-collaboration.
ESD is increasingly collaborating with the Department of Public Service, NYSERDA, and NYPA to align on responsive policies and programs. For example, this year, the $300 million Power-Up Fund will support the proactive development of electric infrastructure to create power-ready sites that can accommodate new commercial industrial investment opportunities. ESD is working hand-in-hand with DPS on this initiative.
Harris characterizes the energy plan as ambitious but achievable.
This is a very pragmatic plan. We know we need to solve for multiple variables at the same time, and this takes a real bottoms-up look at how we can practically be planning into the future against those priorities. So what I'd want New Yorkers to know is that these are critical parts of the way we live and work. Our energy system is something that needs to be affordable, reliable, and support all the good things happening as we bring in new industries to our state. And this multifaceted plan is really moving forward a path to achieve those outcomes.
As New York seeks to electrify housing, transportation, and other infrastructure, Republicans in the state legislature have remained skeptical of the cost and feasibility of meeting the state's green energy goals. The public comment period runs through October 6.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Primary voters won't cast their ballots for almost a year, but the two candidates officially vying for the governor's mansion are already racing to raise campaign funds. Grant Ashley of the New York Public News Network explains.
Incumbent Governor Kathy Hochul raised more than $4.3 million in the first half of the year, according to July campaign filings from the State Board of Elections. Hochul spent more than $1.8 million, leaving her with about $17.5 million in cash on hand. Hochul's campaign war chest dwarfs that of her Democratic rival, Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, who had about $1.4 million in reserves. Delgado raised just under $1.5 million in the first half of this year, but he raised the majority of that money, over $1 million, since officially launching his campaign on June 2nd. Delgado is also taking advantage of New York's Public Campaign Finance Program, which is available to statewide candidates for the first time this election cycle. Under the program, donations made by individuals that are between $5 and $250 are matched by the state at a 6-to-1 ratio. For example, a qualifying $100 donation would unlock $600 of state funds, allowing a candidate to bring in $700. Delgado would need to raise $500,000 from 5,000 individuals in order to qualify. Under state rules, the lieutenant governor has raised about $220,000 qualifying dollars from just over 3,000 qualifying individual donors. Delgado told BTPM NPR that the matching funds program would allow him to focus on everyday people instead of large donors.
I don't take corporate PAC money. I only build with, you know, real people. And New York also has public matching funds, which is a very important new dynamic in gubernatorial races, where I can connect with, you know, folks all across the state who might not be the richest, might not be the wealthiest.
Hochul is not participating in the public campaign finance program. No Republicans have officially announced a run for the governor's mansion. Congressman Mike Lawler was mulling a campaign, but he announced last week that he would run for re-election to his House seat instead. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik told supporters at a rally in Erie County it was a matter of when, not if, she would launch a campaign. Stefanik's campaign says she raised $4 million in the second quarter of the year from 50,000 unique donors. The congresswoman had $11 million on hand in her congressional campaign account. Hochul is taking aim at Stefanik. The governor has criticized the, quote, far-right congresswoman for supporting tariffs and health care cuts. In an interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe, Hochul said she's not worried about any challengers in the gubernatorial race.
You know, I don't worry about those things. That is down the road. I suspect there are people conspiring against me for next year, you know, whether it's Republicans or something.
You know,
it goes with the turf. I mean, I can handle this. You know, it's my 16th election. I know how to do this. And so, you know, I always say bring it on.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Grant Ashley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Sarah Rogerson, distinguished professor of law at Albany Law School and director of the Edward P. Swire Justice Center, to talk about immigration and specifically New York's Protect Our Courts Act.
New York has a law on the books called the Protect Our Courts Act, which I was very proud to be a part of that movement to get that law passed, because it was part of the efforts around the first Trump administration, right? This goes all the way back to something called the Sensitive Locations Memo, which is not something you would know about unless you are really into this immigration stuff. But I unearthed the original Sensitive Locations Memo, which was a memo decades ago by the former INS, or Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is now the Department of Homeland Security. And basically, it was the federal immigration law enforcement policy that they would not target quote-unquote sensitive locations for enforcement, and it included places like churches and schools and hospitals. It followed a couple of unfortunate immigration enforcement actions that happened at or near these sensitive locations. And the federal government said, hey, we don't think we're doing this correctly, and we're going to course correct. Notably, the sensitive locations memo did not include courthouses. And so one of the things that happened under the first Trump administration was they thought, well, if we want to increase our capture rate for undocumented folks, we will basically stock the state courthouses. And that raised an important issue of federalism. What sort of authority do states have over the federal law enforcement in and around state courthouses? And that sort of was what gave birth to the Protect Our Courts Act when ICE, under the first Trump administration, began targeting places like family courts. And advocates in Manhattan, but then the movement moved upstate as well, including a lot of public defenders, were in an outrage about this because they were losing litigants. They were losing witnesses. You think about all the things that you do in a courthouse and then really making that a scary place to go, it really interrupts the system of justice in any given state for federal law enforcement to do that.
Sarah Rogerson, just in general, it seems to me with a lot of the policies and the fear of retribution behind them, that this is designed to create a chilling effect when it comes to immigration. People coming to the country, getting people to hurry up and leave the country, and all the ripple effects from that.
Right. And I failed to mention what the Protect Our Courts Act does, which is it makes sure that federal law enforcement agents coming in and out of these halls of justice have a legitimate purpose for being there. And when we think about immigration enforcement, unfortunately, it's tied in our minds to criminal law enforcement activity, but it's not. Immigration law is largely civil. There are some immigration crimes, but they are few and numerable. So these enforcement actions taken by ICE are not done with the same controls that a lot of criminal arrests have around, you know, Fourth and Fifth Amendments, so search and seizure and a lot of other really important foundational constitutional rights. And when you start to not just erode those rights, but erode the rights that folks have to seek protection, right? A large group of folks who are deterred when ICE targets state courthouses or federal courthouses for that matter is lawfully either protecting themselves from harm or seeking compensation or punishment for others who have broken the law and it has impacted them. So it's not just a fear-based tactic. It also keeps people not only from being able to access immigration status, but being able to protect themselves generally, which makes immigrants a richer target for actual criminals.
Because of the Protect Our Courts Act, Sarah, does that make New York's courts safer on some level for immigrants than other states?
That's the idea. And it sends the message that if you are in New York and you need to be in a courthouse, we are saying that we are trying as a state to keep ICE from using your access to the courts to detain you and then prevent your access of anywhere else. So that's the idea. There isn't a lot of data about how effective this law has been. I know that there are people who are looking into that, but unfortunately, in this climate, the Department of Justice on the federal level is now attacking that law because they want to be able to come into courthouses of any kind as one of many tactics by the Trump administration to try to capture as many people as possible.
Well, now this is my complete ignorance, Sarah Rogerson, but we have seen ICE agents with their face covered in masks, not identified, smashing windows of cars, pulling people off the streets. And it seems like those, in many of the cases I've seen, had green cards or were there legitimately, in one case, going to a hearing at a court. Aren't there rules about law enforcement making themselves identifiable to people when they attempt to arrest them?
Right. So that's one of the big problems with the ICE enforcement force as a whole, right, is that they fly under in a weird sort of space in the law because of who they're targeting. So the people that they're targeting as undocumented immigrants or immigrants generally in this country, There are lower standards of proof. There are fewer constitutional rights protections.
Why? What is the justification for that?
Well, that's a complicated question. But essentially, different courts have ruled that there are lower baselines to inquire into the private comings and goings of undocumented folks because of their really second-class citizen status in the country. And the Trump administration has done a really good job of linking immigrants to crime, which is a total myth that has been debunked by even right-leaning think tanks like the Cato Institute. So,
and yet there are these anecdotal examples that keep happening where you hear undocumented immigrant.
Yeah. And the opponents of immigration are really good at hyping up those cases and making them sensational and spectacular. And I don't mean to denigrate the victims of any of these attacks, but it's just not supported by the vast majority of statistical evidence. In fact, the opposite is true, that when there's a larger concentration of immigrants in a community, crime rates actually drop, which we've seen happen across the country.
That's Sarah Rogerson, Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Edward P. Swire Justice Center at Albany Law School. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a lawsuit against the Ulster County Clerk for repeatedly refusing to file a summary judgment against a New York doctor who prescribed abortion pills to a Texas patient via telehealth. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Paxton first sued Dr. Margaret Carpenter of New Paltz in civil court last year for allegedly violating the state's abortion ban. Texas prohibits nearly all abortions, but New York has refused to cooperate with Texas in accordance with its Shield Law, which protects abortion providers from out-of-state lawsuits. When Carpenter failed to respond to the suit, a Texas judge issued a permanent injunction and a more than $100,000 fine against her, but that still hasn't been carried out. Twice, acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brooke says he has received orders from Paxton to file the judgment against Carpenter in New York, but he won't do it.
Since everything that the doctor did was legal in New York State, she never left New York State. Our interpretation of the Shield Law made it pretty clear that we were not to comply with it, and so we rejected it based on that. Nothing has changed on our end. The law hasn't changed from our perspective. We are still not to comply with anything like this.
Paxton, a Republican, is now seeking a writ of mandamus in New York to force Brooke to file the judgment. In a statement, he says Carpenter is a, quote, radical abortionist who must face justice, not get legal protection from New York liberals intent on ending the lives of as many unborn children as they can, end quote. The case is considered the first major test of Shield laws protecting abortion providers in the U.S. New York is one of 8 states with such laws. Opponents say they are unconstitutional and that states are required to respect the laws and rulings of other states. Legal experts like Mary Ziegler, a law professor from UC Davis, say it's possible the matter will make its way to the Supreme Court.
It's definitely something we've expected to see. This is a question about states' rights, right? And when states have to listen to one another.
The Texas case isn't the only one Carpenter faces. She has been indicted on criminal charges in Louisiana for allegedly prescribing abortion pills there. New York has refused to extradite Carpenter in that case. Carpenter has largely refused to comment on the lawsuits, but the Abortion Coalition for Telemedicine, which Carpenter co-founded, has stressed in its statements that the 2-pill regimen for medicated abortions is a, quote, essential part of women's health care that has been proven safe and effective globally for decades, end quote. Democratic New York Governor Kathy Hochul blasted Paxton's lawsuit in a statement, calling it pathetic and dangerous. New York has amped up its laws protecting abortion providers in recent months, allowing doctors to now list their practice instead of their names on prescription labels. As for Brooke, he says he's not sure what to expect going forward. He says county and state lawyers are likely to get involved, especially if the case is appealed, and he's retaining an attorney for himself.
It's a bit of a whirlwind today, a little frustrating. Ken Paxton's press release talked about how radical liberals in New York are trying to kill as many babies as possible, and I now have a daughter who's 3 months old, and that's extremely offensive to me that they would frame the decision that we made as trying to intentionally kill children. It's just completely absurd. We're trying to protect doctors. That's what we're doing.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
New York's early intervention program serves about 70,000 children between birth and age 3 who have developmental delays or disabilities, or at least it's supposed to. New York's program is ranked last in the nation for the timely delivery of services. About half of the children who are eligible for therapy don't actually get it, and the system has lost thousands of therapists in just the last few years. That has far-reaching consequences for children and the entire state education system. Amy Feireisel reports for the New York Public News Network.
In rural Washington County, there are some therapies for children that are completely unavailable. Autumn Headwell is a service coordinator for the county's early intervention department.
For example, we have no OT in Southern Washington County, like at all.
OT stands for occupational therapist.
So if there's a child that has sensory concerns or fine motor concerns, we can't provide them services.
Headwell says other services like speech therapy are also severely limited. And Washington County is no anomaly. It's more the standard. New York's early intervention program has been in trouble for a long time. The many reasons can essentially be boiled down to pay. Early intervention therapists are treated as independent contractors. And while they're doing state work, they don't get state benefits or wages. And their hourly pay is essentially the same, even a little lower than when the program was started in the mid-1990s. Christy Bitzrutzik lives in Plattsburgh, and she's a former early intervention therapist.
We're New York State certified teachers and providers, and we can't tap into a New York State healthcare system or retirement system or a tiered pay system. We have providers starting less than what I started in 1998.
Pay has stayed stagnant over the course of several different New York governors and administrations from both sides of the aisle. But Srotzik says it's pushed agencies out of business, and it's led therapists to look for jobs elsewhere, in hospitals, for insurance companies, school districts.
And when you just look side by side, it's a no-brainer. You can't blame someone for wanting to do better for their family.
But there's more than that. 2,000 therapists left during the COVID-19 pandemic. Even more have left in the past year. Last October, there was a disastrous rollout of a new state billing system, which led to many therapists going unpaid for months. Then there's the delay of a 5% rate increase, the first in decades. It was promised in last year's state budget, and it still hasn't taken effect.
So the fact that the rate increase was promised and has not come into place is incredibly discouraging. And of course, they're just leaving.
That's Bridget Hurley, a chief program officer at the Children's Agenda, a state advocacy group that's been pushing for early intervention reform.
The folks who are left providing early intervention services in New York State are heroes. It's just not a tenable employment right now.
NCPR has repeatedly asked the state about its failure to serve half of the children who are eligible for therapy. The state's Department of Health and the Office of Family and Children Services have never directly answered the question. In emails, they say the state is, quote, committed to supporting and enhancing early intervention services, end quote. Hurley says it's unfair to New York families that this federally mandated service is not being provided.
Kids have a right to these services. They have a right to these services in a particular time frame, and those rights are being violated.
This leaves parents in a position of having to fight for their child's rights, and in lieu of professional help, doing a lot of detective and guesswork.
I try to do as much research as I can. Do I know it all? No. So it's like our whole downstairs looks like a Montessori school, really.
That's Kaylee Yeager. She lives in Hamlin, a town in Monroe County, about 30 minutes west of Rochester. Her son Matthew has autism, and when he was 2, he qualified for speech and occupational therapy through early intervention. He got a year of the speech, but only a month of the OT. Yeager says she wonders what gains Matthew could have made with more occupational therapy, if he would have made progress on the physical skills he struggles with.
How to hold a pencil, how to cut with scissors, how to walk up and down the steps safely.
Yeager stopped working to care for her son full time, but she says that's not something everyone can do.
So us speaking out on this topic is also for all those parents that are working a 9-to-5 plus or just don't have the ability to advocate the way that we do.
And it shouldn't be this hard, she says. A parent shouldn't have to be chasing down federally mandated help. Yeager says the state isn't setting up its children for success and that that's a choice, to not raise pay, to not incentivize therapists to join early intervention.
New York State is in a crisis, and they're breaking federal law. Like, this is our future.
And a kid doesn't stay two forever. The lack of intervention compounds as they grow up. Bridget Hurley from the Children's Agenda says because kids aren't getting therapy when they're younger, they head into public school with bigger issues, which costs more money.
When you wait, it's a lot more expensive and you don't make as much progress with that child.
She says what can cost a couple $1,000s from 0 to 3 years old costs taxpayers between $14,000 and $18,000 annually on the K-12 level.
Of course, not to mention the impact on that child and the family and honestly, the community in the long term, because that child may need lots of services as an adult.
She says the price of that failure will be paid by children, their families, and their communities, because in the end, the buck has to stop somewhere. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2531. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.